Okay, now if you watch the evening news or any news, listen to it on the radio, it just seems to be repetitively tragic. So many evil things going on in the world. You'll hear about the latest shooting, wherever that may have been, or the latest flooding. There have been floods in various places. Other places, they don't have drinking water. They're lacking water. Latest tornado, we just saw on the news a couple nights ago of places that were just devastated by a tornado that ran through. And it showed people standing by what was left of their house, which was nothing. We hear about the latest rioting for various reasons in various places. And the list goes on and on. So much tragic news going on. And each of these instances involves a tragedy, sometimes for one person, or a lot of times for many people. And it affects families and neighborhoods, businesses and schools, and other facets of life. And in each case, we see and hear the tragic losses that are suffered by one or more people. We see and hear stories of those directly suffering losses. And then on the other side, those who are so quick to respond and to provide help. And it's reassuring to see that there are people who do that. And then we hear about some of the long-term effects for individuals. And then just on to the next story, on to the traffic reports, the weather, the sports, and other things to take our minds off the main breaking news. We quickly lose track of the individuals involved. After all that happened 10 minutes ago. My mind's moved past that. Because these are other people. I use other people in quotes. People we don't know, and people we likely never will know. But God does know them. He knows every one of these other people. He knows their lives and their families, their problems, their triumphs, their hopes, their plans. And the time will come when every one of these individuals will learn about God's plan for all of mankind. And they will be able to take steps to follow him. But not yet. It's not time for that yet. So the main point of this message is that there are no other people with God. He knows and loves them all. And he will work with them in his own way and his own time. And the title of this message is God's Other People with Other in quotation marks. It refers to the millions and billions of others outside the comprehension of our own individual lives and minds. The first point I would like to bring up, and I started out calling these points, but really they're more like thoughts, because it isn't a progressive step from one point to another, but it's just thoughts that come to mind when you think about these. What are our own thoughts about these other people? Our human minds just tend to get bogged down when we try to understand other people's situations. And the news reports, like I mentioned, may show them standing in the spot where their home once stood, and they're trying to comprehend what happened. No amount of comforting from others can compensate for those losses. Now, with few exceptions, most of us in the room here don't know the people involved, and there may be a time when we do know someone who lives in that area or something. But unless we've been in that area or experienced something similar, it's hard to really understand what they're going through. Is that the right attitude we should have, though? The book of Galatians talks about what kind of attitude we should have toward others. In Galatians chapter 6, I'll be reading a few verses out of Galatians 6. We'll start Galatians 6, verse 1. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. And it tells us in verse 2 that we should bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. So we're supposed to care about these people, but generally we aren't in a position to do that directly, because these are other people. They're in a distant location. If we continue on in verse 3, for if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. For each one shall bear his own load. Verse 6, let him who has taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And verse 9 and 10 are the key verses I wanted to focus on. Verse 9 of Galatians 6, and let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Now, I try to imagine myself in each of these situations that are being described, and their experience is something that just can't sink in right away. First of all, I'd see the physical damages, because that's what they show, and I try to comprehend that. And sometimes the physical side is a little easier to deal with than the emotional side. But given the resources, both financial and physical, much of the physical property could be restored. Maybe not everything, but they could rebuild their house if they had time and money and people to do it. That could be restored. What I think about if I were in that situation? Well, first of all, I'd like to think I would be grateful that my physical life was spared, along with the lives of friends and neighbors. And next, I would start thinking about all the little things that may be very simple, inexpensive, but they carry meaning and memories that are lost, can't be passed down to others. I think of things such as their personal photos that help document those lives. In many cases, those are just gone. Now, in my own case, I have gone through the process of scanning all of the family and personal physical photos and slides and negatives that I could find from my own family and some of my ancestors. So as long as these scans are still accessible, I could reproduce most of the images. But still, there's something special about the original photos, which were handled and viewed by my parents and grandparents, maybe great-grandparents and others who were alive at the time the photos were taken. They knew the history of the occasion. And I was thinking of one picture in particular. It was of my older sister when she was, I would guess, about 4 years old, sitting on a stool, kind of with her leg draped over the stool. And my dad at the time, these were black and white photos, but he had gotten some kind of photo paints, and he started touching up some of these pictures. And on this one, he painted a yellow dress on her, and it looked very nice, very, very bright. But then I looked at the back of the photo. My mom had written a caption on it. My sister's name was Sharon. She said, "This is Sharon in her new blue dress." And so something was lost there, something, even though I have the picture. I guess in having the original picture, I have that additional meaning that goes with it. Now, as I was preparing this message, it seemed like several relevant stories or activities or news items came my way, just to make it more meaningful. For example, there was an article in the Minneapolis paper on Wednesday, May 24th, that happened to talk about this very thing, about photos that were lost. And the headline was, "A Family's Treasured Photos Were Stolen. Can You Help Find Them?" And right away, I could identify with that. I'll just read sections of this article. It's not very long. It says, Tiffany Enriquez packed up the chapters of her family's story, photo albums, wedding keepsakes, letters and journals and newspaper clippings about the father she lost when she was 8 years old, all tucked inside two black plastic milk crates for Sunday's move. They meant everything to the Enriquez family. These were all the little details about the family. They were worth nothing to the thief who stole them. She describes them. She says, wedding albums, family photo album, pretty much all my family's memorabilia, said Enriquez, who forgot to lock her car after she placed the two black plastic milk crates inside. When she came back to her vehicle in the Corcoran neighborhood in South Minneapolis, the crates and their cargo were gone. She's hoping the thief might have dumped those two plastic crates and their treasure somewhere around town. She's hoping someone will read these words and help bring them home. She goes on to say, there was nothing of value to the person who grabbed them, so I'm desperately hoping they were left in an alley or somewhere to be found, she wrote in an email asking for help. If we can spread the word far enough, I feel hopeful someone will notice and reach out. Among the photos and albums were the papers of her late father, Carlos Enriquez, a student activist at the University of Minnesota who died in 1987. So it was photos, memorabilia from her father that are gone too. It says he was a former stonemason who died just as he was about to earn his degree at age 44. He left behind a wife, six children, and a legacy as an artist, journalist, and tireless advocate for the minority and non-traditional students at the university. His daughter had gathered the records of his years at the university, hoping to donate them to the school's Department of Chicano and Latino Studies. And as she packed them up, she snapped a photo of one of the memorial letters. And this photo of one of the letters is all that she has that remains of them, at least so far, unless someone returns something. And in this letter that she took a picture of, it said, as Carlos Enriquez touched our lives and left us the better for the association, so his death touches us now and leaves a void, read one eulogy from the members of the Special Committee on Minority Programs, a void that may close somewhat with time, but one that can never be made completely whole. Now that letter is gone. She has just the photo of it. Along with baby photos, funeral cards, all the mementos of life in between. Enriquez is kicking herself for forgetting to lock the car, even though she's not the one who did anything wrong. She says, I was pretty much the family record keeper. I'm pretty sure I've been fired from that job now, she said with a sad laugh, trying to bring a little humor out. There certainly wasn't much humor to bring out. She said, I'm feeling sad for humanity. And it goes on to say, if you know anything about this, if you see the milk crates or anything, it tells you where you can write to the paper to let them get word to her. So just as this example describes, the photos, photo scans and images, as important as they are to me, others in my family, to anybody else, they're nearly meaningless. They're just pictures of other people. They don't matter. They're other people. Other people, such as those shown on the news reports. But God knows even more about the people in my family photos than I do. He knows every person pictured, every detail about their lives. He knows when and where and why each photo was taken. He even knows about every incident that wasn't recorded. He knows about stuff that goes on the outside at the time the picture was happening. Photos can record only a very small fraction of anyone's life. Other records may include newspaper clippings or diaries. The idea of diaries is one that's been become a little more familiar with me. From time to time, we may read about someone who tries to find descendants of a person in a photo, or the author of a diary or other object which contains enough information to track it down. Now, I live in Anoka, which is about 20 miles northwest of Minneapolis. And I volunteer one afternoon a week at our local history center. And some of the things I've done there in the past have been to scan photos and try to identify them and put them into their collection, their system that keeps records of that. But another interesting project I was given was to transcribe the diaries that were written by a 16-year-old girl back in the 1890s. And I was just fascinated by them. There were six diaries. They were each about, 8 by 10, not a little less than 8 by 10, maybe 7 by 9 or something like that. And I don't know how many pages they contained. They were just these type of diaries that are, the pages are just sewn in the back. So say roughly maybe 30 pages in each one, six of them. They describe daily lives for family and relatives and friends. They give a good general representation of typical living at that time. They were all just other people. Now, because of the diaries, they mean more to me because of this involvement. Their house is still standing, the house where she lived in back in the early 1900s, or 1890s even. That house is still standing, along with other houses in the neighborhood she lived in. And nearly every day, except when it's inadvisable because of the weather, I walk by that area where her house stood, and I can look down the street. I go within about half a block where their house stood. And it's interesting. There was a fire in 1884 that destroyed a lot of buildings in town, but this building was saved, so her father moved the house to the present location. There was already a house there, but that didn't matter. He just butted this one up against it, and the two connected houses are still there. One little problem, if you want to call it that, is the floors didn't quite match up, so they come together like this, and there's some kind of a ramp, I guess, or a step or something between the floors. I've never been inside, but I hope to sometime, and I'm hoping that on behalf of the History Center, I can bring them a copy of Alice's diary and just present it to them, and then me, along with someone from the History Center, can. A real reason for me anyway is to just see what it's like inside. But the diaries describe day-to-day life at the time, who they visited, who else was there, what they did. Her father Sam was struck by an artillery shell during the Civil War that eventually caused him to go blind, but still he was able to serve as the Anoka postmaster for 5 years. Not sure how he did that. I'm sure his wife would have helped him. He died in 1913. Alice describes the new high school, which was built in 1905. That building still stands. It's a school administration building now, but used to be a junior high school. I went to grades 7 through 9 in that building. My dad taught school there when we first moved to Minnesota. And that school is about 4 blocks away from where her family lived. Now, life at that time would have been the same in several ways, but very different in other ways from life today. The telephone had been invented, but it wasn't common in private homes until much later. And she writes of going to, as she says, she had to go to Mr. Musseter's store to telephone to see if the train was on time. So, and that, I was fascinated too by trains. It seemed like they knew the schedule of every train that went, or every horse trolley. The public transportation just seemed to way that be the way that people got around. It could go to Minneapolis or St. Paul, or even locally within Anoka. And instead of phoning others, people visited others in their homes, or they gathered together at churches or community events. Selected groups might meet at what they called a sociable, and that's where a group of people were invited to a gathering at someone's home or other location. And Alice in her diary mentions more than a dozen of these. It makes it sound like it was just regular events that rotated among several homes. That would be their way to communicate. So whenever I walk through that part of town, I feel like I'm drawn back in time. She and her family would have known some of the houses that still stand in that area. They're houses from 1874, 1881, 1867. And in her lifetime, when she was growing up, they would have been like practically new houses, less than 10 years old. So she and her family and friends are a little more than other people to me now, but I still have never met her or anyone who knew or knew of her family. And despite reading about her daily life and being able to piece together a lot of things with these surroundings, I still don't know her. She and all the others I read about are still just other people to me. But at the same time, all of them are other people that God knows everything about. There's a website that I found my way to. I wasn't necessarily looking for it, but I was led to this one. And it talks about how a diary from 1938 was returned to the original owner's family. And the headline, this was dated April 12, 2022. The headline was "Long Lost Diary from 1938 Returned to Pennsylvania Family." She said, the article said, a Pennsylvania woman whose grandson found a diary from 1938, more than two decades ago, said the book is on its way to being reunited with its original owner's family. Lisa Kuhlbaugh of Eaton Township said her grandson found a diary dated from 1938 in a bag of trash that had been thrown out after a house cleaning several years ago. She said, I've had it for years. My grandson was only 7 at the time, and he'll be 30 in August. See, so she recently posted about the diary. It belonged to someone named Donald D. Meeker. Posted it on Facebook, and word got out. There was a TV news report about the misplaced heirloom, and that led to her being contacted by the Meeker's daughter-in-law. And this daughter-in-law said, and I'll quote what she said, I thought, oh my God, Donald D. Meeker, Murray Street, that's our pop-pop, said the daughter-in-law, identified as Marianne. So apparently that's what they had called him. She said her late husband, George, was Donald D. Meeker's son. And she said the diary must have been thrown away accidentally while cleaning out a family member's house. We cleaned the house out in 44, and apparently we were guilty of getting rid of this, which I feel very bad about. But it was meant to be, and we got it, and we retrieved it. So my daughter is going to treasure it with her two girls, Marianne said. And then these two people, the people who found the diary and the people who whose family it was about, said they were surprised to learn that they had mutual friends and said they plan to keep in touch. So there's kind of a connection. So these were just other people, didn't know anything about each other until they made this connection. But they were never other people in God's eyes. He knew all about them all along. And maybe that he worked somehow to make this all happen. We don't know. But no matter what we learn from photos, diaries, journals, the people in them still remain other people to us. But God knows and knows about every one of these other people. He has a plan that will eventually include every one of them. David understood some of this type of thinking in his Psalms. In Psalm 40, verse 5, he said, you don't need to turn there, I'm just reading the one verse, Psalm 40, verse 5, and your thoughts which are toward us cannot be recounted to you in order. If I would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered. So God thinks about and comprehends far more than we can ever understand. We can try to comprehend the depths of God's understanding and appreciation of our lives and of the lives of others, but we just can't do it. In Psalm 40, verse 17, David expresses this wonder and awe of God's presence in our lives. Psalm 40, verse 17 says, just one short verse, says, but I am poor and needy, yet the Lord thinks upon me. You are my hope and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God. So David knew that God knew about him and his life and cared about him. So that was the first thought. The second one, I want to ask, how many people do you know? There are about 8 billion people living in the world today. There are estimates that about 117 billion people have ever been born on Earth. There's a New York Times article from 2013 that tries to estimate how many people the average American knows. And they say in this article, it was from February 19th, 2013, they say the average American knows about 600 people. How do we know this? They say researchers led by my Columbia colleague, Qian Zheng, posed a series of questions to a representative sample of 1,500 Americans. How many people do you know named Kevin? How many named Karen? How many named Sean or Brenda or Keith or Rachel? He picked some representative names, a list of names that could be used. And here's how they use them. Now, if we were to do it today, we might have to select different names that are a little more appropriate. But after adjusting for various factors, continuing in this article, for example, the names are not evenly distributed in age across the population, we determined that participants knew an average of 8.4 people with those names. I wouldn't want to be that 0.4 of a person. I wouldn't want to think about it. Anyway, an average of 8.4 people. And they say Social Security records suggest that 1.4% of the population has one of the names, and 8.4 divided by 1.4% is 600 people. So the logic doesn't matter. They had a method, and it kind of made sense to come up with a number. But let's say 600 people is the number of people we know. out of 8 billion people on Earth today, that 600 isn't all that many. And it would be fair to say that in round numbers, nearly all of the 8 billion people are unknown to us. They are all other people. Now, even these 600 people, if we actually knew that many people and could call them by name, that doesn't mean that we really know them necessarily. We know their name, we can match a name and a face, and that's important, but we might not know about their families, we wouldn't know about what their prior lives were like, what their hopes are for the future. So they're still just other people. But every one of them is known by God. Every one of them is one of God's other people. Does that make them any of them less important to God? The fact that we don't know them doesn't mean anything to God. Dale Carnegie wrote a book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it was originally written in 1936, but it's been popular throughout the decades. I imagine it's still being read today. But in his book, he mentions that we need to remember that a person's name is to him the sweetest, most important sound in any language. And that's true. When someone does call you by name, it gets your attention a little more than if they just say, oh, hi, and just walk on. Now, many years ago, and a lot of you were around then, when we had larger congregations than we do today. I'm not sure what the trends were in Eau Claire, but in the Twin Cities, we had over 300 people in the Minneapolis North congregation, and about 1,000 people total in Minneapolis North, Minneapolis South, and St. Paul. And it was a large crowd when we met for Holy Days. I was pretty much new in the church then, and we'd get together for Holy Days, and I could look around the room and pick out maybe one or two people that I could kind of think of their names, but most of the others were just strangers to me. And it was the same way with the ministers. With the 300 people in our North congregation, we went through a number of ministers that I don't think even knew who I was. At least they didn't let on that they did. They might have been able to look it up and say, "Oh, you must be Dave," kind of guess at it, but. So I felt pretty much unknown by the ministers. So at one gathering just of our local church, I'll say his name because it's important, Larry Walker, who a number of you may remember him or have heard of him, but I happened to pass him just in passing in services, and I just said, "Oh, hi, Mr. Walker." And normally a minister would have said, "Oh, hi," and just walked on, but he didn't. He made me very pleased and even a little proud when he said, "Hi, Dave," back to me. He wasn't looking at notes. He had done enough research to know who I was. So it made me feel important, and knowing someone's name is important. But still, doesn't mean you know the person. There are those who may brag that they know thousands of people by name, but that doesn't mean that they truly know these people, not like God knows them. And God does know, and he cares. That's the third thought of this message. God cares about everyone. He says in Luke 12, 6 and 7, this is a familiar passage, you don't need to turn there, but Luke 12, 6 and 7, "Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 copper coins? And not one of them is forgotten before God, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered." And I used to know how many hairs we have on our head, but When I try to count it, the number gets a little less every time. But you know, I think an estimate was 5,000 hairs on the head. Doesn't matter. It's in the thousands. God is able to know every one of the hairs on our head even. So if, presumably, if you, someone gave God a hair from your head, he would say, oh, I knew who that is, and he would know. Now going on about names, there are over 3,000 names in the Bible that are recorded, and that's in the Old Testament alone. Over 3,000 names are mentioned, and there's sometimes more than an identity tag. Names sometimes revealed a person's character or personality, destiny. There are several biblical references to a new name signifying a new beginning or a new opportunity or position. For example, in Genesis 17, it talks about Abram, who was renamed Abraham, and Sarai, or however you say that, who was renamed Sarah. In Genesis 32, it talks about Jacob. That name apparently meant the crafty one or the overreacher. Jacob was renamed Israel, one who has strived with God and prevailed. His new name signified new meaning to the person. Simon was renamed Peter. In the international article, our International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, if you look in the article under names, it says the Bible presents people not as a mass, nor as a fraction of a mass, or as cases to be studied, but as persons, real people. The proper name in the Bible is the symbol of the person, and to address a person by name is to give that person significance, meaning, dignity, and worth. But still, even if we can call 1,000 people by name or whatever name, number you want to throw out, we still don't really know them. Most of them are still other people in our lives, but they're not other people to God. I have one final story here as I start to close up here. There was an article in the, again, in the Minneapolis paper on Sunday, May 7th. Was that just 3 weeks or last month, a month ago, or a little over a month ago? The heading on the article was, "From St. Paul Plowing to Teacher Pay, Readers Debate My Columns." And there was a big problem then with snow plowing in the Twin Cities and probably all over, that we had so much snow that the plows couldn't keep up with it. There were cases where cars were plowed in because they were left parked by the curb. Snowplow couldn't get around, so it just had to plow them. I mean, it couldn't get to the curb where they were standing, so it just had to plow around them. And then there were these big ruts in the roads. Traffic was a mess. Buses couldn't get through. Just lots of complaints. And in this article, he said, one reader called and told about getting his VW Beetle stuck in a rut on the unplowed Kellogg Boulevard in front of St. Paul City Hall in 1963. So this isn't a new issue. It's been happening for decades, apparently. But at any rate, back then, this reader said he was so livid about this, he decided to go inside and tell off the mayor. He was going to do something about it. He said, seated at the reception desk in the mayor's office was a woman with whom he had gone to school. He said, immediately he felt foolish because he recognized he wasn't dealing with a faceless institution, but someone just like him, and that really was a strong point to him. This was an other person, but it was someone just like him. And that's true about all the other people in our lives that we don't know. When you get down to it, it's someone just like us. These other people we read about or hear about aren't nameless and faceless, but just like us. So we, individually or collectively, may be just other people to the majority of people living in areas just around us. For most of them, day-to-day life would continue just the same, whether or not we were around. And it's true if you could somehow measure the effect we make. If we suddenly weren't here, there might be a little ripple around us, but wouldn't have to go out too far, and it wouldn't make any difference to people. Day-to-day life would continue just the same whether we were around or not. But there are no other people to God. God knows and has eventual plans for every one of them.